Good evening, everyone, and welcome to another fantastic night of Fandom Access. I am your ever-faithful host, AJ. Greetings and salutations. We got a slam-bang show for you tonight. Joining us once again is Gary Morgenstein to talk about his show, Joyland, which can be viewed on YouTube. He's bringing along director Damon Serafin and actress Rosalind Seely. And then after that, we'll talk to our normal crew. Well, our normal shows, I mean. I can't talk tonight. That's not good. And then I'm going to bring in Karen.
Hi, AJ.
Good evening, Karen.
How are you
tonight? I am good.
That's
so
great.
It looks like we have, I don't know if they're calling in together or individually, but it looks like we have Gary. I'm going to step out for a second and make sure it's one of them and not a stalker. I'll be right back.
Okay. You never know who might be in the queue. You got to make sure you screen them. We've learned the hard way. check who's on the line.
Why is it not
switching
me
over? I think they should be calling separately.
Hello?
Because people are still locked down.
Well, this is weird
here.
Because I know I'm clicking on screen. It's loading the screen, and I'm still with you. Oh, I know. I got to put me on screen too, I think. Hold on.
So we don't get a lot. We haven't had a lot of callers lately, so I understand you're out of practice working the switchboard.
They're bringing you into the queue.
But,
oops. Come on. There we go.
Off.
All right. Here he is. No, it was just Blog Talk Radio being silly.
Hi, Karen.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
Good. Happy Tuesday.
Yeah, happy Tuesday.
Thanks for having
Great
me
to
on.
Great to have you back.
Yes.
It's a joy.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. We're very excited. Episode 2, Damon and Rosalind will be calling in.
Mm-hmm. That's fantastic. I'm really excited.
Yeah.
A month was a long time.
Yeah.
A long time to wait between episodes.
I know. I'm sorry. I know. You know, the writer room, singular, goes so fast.
Mm-hmm.
He only goes so fast. But we figure each month is good, and as you know, we've created the production.
Oh, yeah.
I really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I liked – you know, Gary, I'll be honest with you. The background – you know, where you upgraded the background images alone, it kind of immerses you more into the story, even though it's, you know, just actors sitting in front of their cameras and reading the lines. The background images, I felt, for me, really brought me further into the story, which was really cool.
Oh, that's great. Thank you very much. Well, it was Damon's inspiration. Damon issued the challenge. He said, we're not doing any stage directions or any directions. I said, well, what, are you sure? This is Zoom. And he said, no, we're going to do it. And so the challenge went out. It went out, first of all, it went out to himself as the director and the cast. To lean into it more, which is, you know, it's amazing what you could do if you push the buttons and push the envelope. And we found that Zoom expanded. And I think it really does work. It is, you know, you get the intimacy and of Zoom, but you really begin to, don't you feel fine that you forgot that you were watching Zoom?
Well, I forgot I was watching Zoom because I watched it in the YouTube app on my television. And so last month I watched it on my laptop, and it really felt like a Zoom because you got the Zoom format. I'm looking at that small screen. But watching it through the app on my television, which I almost never do, really, and it comes up in sort of like a letterbox on my TV. And so it really had the feel of a movie to me.
Right.
Watching
Thank
it.
You. Yes.
Yeah, I watched it on my TV, too.
Yes. So did I, except for the 47,000 times we sat editing.
Yeah.
Apart from that, you know, how the sausage is made, and we have our brilliant technical producer, Paul Litwack, has just done wonders you know, phasing it. And the story, I think, is really taking off. The actors are just so wonderful, and we're really able to lean into, you know, bringing the times of the 1960s. And it seems, you know, we wanted to walk that line between doing a period piece while making it timely and relevant.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, you have to tell me, you know, what you think, because I really would, because I know what I think. I want to hear what you think. But, you know, it's just everyone is kind of caught up in, you know, the struggle, not just for civil rights and social justice, but to get ahead and to take on the establishment.
Right. Or, depending on how you see that, to not lose what you have.
Yeah.
Which is sort of like, you know, what motivates a lot of discrimination. This idea that if somebody gets something, you lose something.
Yes, exactly.
Right?
It's yes. And everyone in the show is kind of shoulder to shoulder with someone else trying to nudge them aside for whatever the reason.
Right.
And, you know, take the power away or push the responsibility. I mean, Reverend Julian Baskin, wonderfully played by Jameel Dobson, is the Baptist minister. He wants to make a name for himself within the establishment, but then, you know, all the established churches are saying, well, no, you have to wait in line.
Right.
You know, and then he's crowded by,
yeah.
You know, Minister Elijah X of the Black Muslims, who's, you know, scolding him, if not ridiculing him, for believing that there isn't going to be such a thing as real justice.
Right. And don't, you know, you have to take it. Don't wait your turn. You have to take it if you're going to get it.
Right. So which is it? So everyone's kind of caught on the horns of this dilemma of how far to go, how far to lose themselves, what kind of chances to take. And look, in episode 2, you know, Marty is, wait, that's my dog scratching. I don't want you to hear my dog scratching on the couch too much. No, you can't do that. You can't scratch on the couch like that. Come and just sit in the corner. Sorry.
It's all right, Gary. You should hear some of the noises we have going on in our houses sometimes.
Yeah, it's good. Okay, now he's on the – yeah. I put the cat in the other room so they don't chase each other, and now Tiger's just on the carpet. He's being very cool. And you know, Marty taking on the establishment, you know, the ABA, people think of the American Basketball Association. They think, rightly so, of the showmanship, of the red, white, and blue ball, of the three-point play, and also the, you know, the fabulous talent. But what this probably has gotten lost in the dustbin of sports history is the fact that the ABA, the NBA had a stranglehold on professional sports.
Mm-hmm.
And the NBA had unofficial quotas on the number of black players. And the NBA, like so many things in American society at that time, was run by wealthy white guys. And there was a lot of class struggle within that, the growth of the ABA was a lot more serious. And they gave chances to people who, for example, Roger Brown, and in the show in episode 1 or 2, Connie Hawkins, who's played by Xavier Rodney, who both of them were, because they had associated with the gambler, Jack Molinas, they were banned from the NBA and accused of allegations of point shaving, of gambling, you know, of throwing games or to you know, to beat the spread or go within the spread. And the fact, but nothing was ever proven of them. But it was just so easy. Okay, we're going to bar these people. What else do you do? You have no recourse. So there's a lot of that. What we try to show in Joyland 2 is the outsiders, the rogues, which was a lot of the 60s, remember. You know, it was, you know, the counterculture.
Yeah, for sure. And I, you know, I feel like this show and talking to Gary is like a history lesson for some of us.
Well, yes. Oh, wait, by the way, Damone says he's in the audience.
Yep. Yeah, Damone and Rosalyn are both here.
Okay.
Hello.
Hi. Welcome.
Thank you.
So glad to
have
you. Oh, we're thrilled to have you. So, Gary, I geeked out today, and I Googled some New York City civil rights history to put everything in perspective and prepare myself. And I thought, oh, Gary's really going to geek out when he hears people have been Googling history.
I love the geeking. I love history geeking. That's my favorite.
I was born in 68, so,
okay.
You know, some of this history predates me. And
yes.
My parents were born in New York City in the 30s, and so you just don't ever see anything bad about New York City in my family.
Yes, good.
So this, you know, is a lot of stuff that I looked up to learn more about the New York City schools boycott in 1964,
yeah.
And the Mother's March across the bridge and all that, and then some of this basketball stuff. I'm not a basketball fan, really.
Yeah.
I think we're all very familiar. Some of what you're saying about sports monopolies remains true with all the major sports today. They've all crushed any form of competition, but they do it a little differently now.
Yes. Well, I'm going to let Rosalind talk.
Yeah.
And Damone talk, please.
Talk
about passing the ball.
So I felt a little bit like this is the episode where stuff really starts to happen, and I feel like this is an episode where we see, like, Tyra really start to become, like, I mean, pretty new kind of, that she was a bit of the boss in that family. But I think that, like, this is an episode where I felt like I got to see a lot more of her, like, not just in terms of being the preacher's wife.
Yeah, exactly. You know, what's interesting is that one of my uncles actually worked for Foster High School, where I live now and where they were living at the time is not very far from there, you know, and this was probably in the 70s, like early 70s, and he had crazy stories about that school. And I grew up in the city, so I definitely have this idea of what was going on in that school and what Tyra had to deal with on a day-to-day basis, you know, to try to get respect, to try to get money, you know, to try to make sure the kids were getting their fair shot. And then coming home to Julian basically in this episode was acting up. And you're like, what is he up to? I don't have time for this. Like, we don't have time for this. And then, you know, eventually coming to the realization that, okay, I need to comfort him. I need to see what's really going on with him. Because we can't keep doing what we're doing.
Yeah, that was kind of interesting, too, because of the way he had been sort of trying to hold Marty to account. And, you know, Marty, I'm not getting involved with this woman if you're going to, you know, cheat on your wife or whatever. And yet he comes home and you know, his wife has to point out to him the ways that he is messing up also.
Yeah, exactly. I think that sometimes men think that I'm here, I'm not doing the worst thing, everything's fine. But it's like, no, you have to do more than that.
Yeah. So that must have been really fun to be able to play her that way. And I mean, I'm not sure where she's going to go, but I imagine the school thing is maybe going to really blow up in the next episode or two.
Mm-hmm.
Situation, right? The situation is coming
yes.
to a.
Yes, I can say that. We can say that.
Hey, Audrey, just FYI.
Yes.
After you.
Yes.
After,
yes.
Are you,
gonna,
can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought
yes, it's going to blow up. Yeah, because
Tyra
is going to be going kind of really head to head.
Hey, Laurie, I'm not coming in, but I was going to tell you. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Now, when you get out of the shower, it's a good time to use that.
Oh, we have some background noise here. Like, someone's got to mute themselves.
The
we're a year into this, and people still don't know how to do that.
Don't forget to put deodorant on either.
I think it might be Alyssa in the background.
It's not me. I live alone.
No. I think it might be AG has a larger household.
So I was just telling that Tyra and Deb Dent
who play the conservative activist, Marty's wife, are going to go butt heads as the school busing erupts. And desegregation.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting because these are two women that are like, I don't know, starting to like feel. I shouldn't say that Tyra's starting to feel more empowered. I think she's been established that way from the start, but Deb certainly is starting to change, right? And feel a little more eager to assert herself, I guess. So and so from what I understand of the history of you know, segregation in New York City, that there was a huge mother's gration, right?
Yes.
Am I right on that?
Yes.
Yeah. So, maybe you base this on that.
You know, a lot of stuff that I lived around me. I remember I was too young to really have a consciousness back in 64. I just really cared about baseball and the Beatles. Really not too
in that order.
Yes, but still. And then in the fall of 1964, my political consciousness was finally opened because Bobby Kennedy, who I revered, ran for the Senate and he won. And he spoke. I was living in Rochdale. We were living in South Jamaica, Rochdale Village, and there was something loosely considered a ball field. You know, if you pulled aside all the glass and the nails, it was a ball field. But they cleaned it up for Bobby Kennedy for his campaign. He gave a speech, and I didn't know a whole bunch, understand really a lot of what he was specifically talking about, but I sure got the sense of hope. And the idealism and the belief of people coming together and the fact that the crowd was of all different people. And it was a beautiful moment to see that and to experience that. And I think, and now I'm going to let Rosalind, you know, pick up on this, but in Joyland, we also like to talk about the hope about people wanting to better themselves. It's not oh my God, this terrible thing has happened. It's people going on with their lives trying to get, you know, improve themselves.
Yeah, I mean, that definitely sounds right. I mean, this is the first time I'm hearing about this Mother's March across the bridge. That's wild. Because growing up, when you hear about busing in the North, you almost always hear about Boston. And I guess it's because their drama happened a little bit later. So people were kind of like, wait, this is still a thing. But I had never heard that story. that's a wild one, about segregation up here in New York, supposedly liberal New York. Actually, you know, I have a lot of family that works in education. One of my uncles was a principal of a high school. And he talked a lot about, he became principal at a time when the city and the state started taking over high schools. So pretty much all the big schools in New York City were divided into smaller schools. There used to be these huge schools, Erasmus Hall, Wingate, South Shore, these huge schools in Brooklyn, all got taken over by the state. Because of test scores and various things. And his school was Beach Channel High School in Queens, in Far Rockaway. And he was there right in that year or two where things were being under review, you know? And he used to always say, and he still says it now, he's like, they wanted to start that school over again. There was nothing I could have done that would have kept that school going, you know? Because once they make up their mind about this is a bunch of black and brown kids, I think that school probably mostly brown based off the demographics at the time. We're not going to put the effort into this. We're not going to try, you know, hopefully the smart kids in the neighborhood will go to one of the specialized schools or go somewhere else. You know, it's just the trap of low expectations, basically. Cause I couldn't imagine what it was like to be a student at that school at that time, knowing that the school was going to close.
Well,
right.
Like as we have in the show, where they say, you know, the custodians finally, you know, Tyra calls
and complains about the rats, and the custodian is, yeah, we really can't do that. And then suddenly he gets the order from on high because the white kids are coming to the school. Well, we're going to get rid of the rats now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, what does that say?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I felt that way a little bit. I mean, I was lucky. My high school was on the other, was in the other side of Brooklyn. So it was like, I used to say my high school was half white and half everything else. But it was by far probably top three best schools in Brooklyn. And it was a non-specialized school. And we also was one of the best schools in the city, period. And I remember my junior year, I was like, I'm not going to take my SAT at my school. It's too far away on a Saturday. I'll go to one of my zone schools. And it was like going to the zone school was like a whole nother experience. You're like, man, this school is falling apart and nobody cares. You know, when I had taken the SAT at my high school, it was like almost a day, like a regular day in school, even though it was a Saturday. It was packed. I went to take the SAT at the zone school. There were like two classrooms full of kids.
Yeah, because not the kids aren't taking it, aren't encouraged to take it.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, oh, I mean, I was probably 16 or 17, and that was like, wow, I've had a very different experience than a lot of my peers who live down the street.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting that you guys are telling the story, you know, at a time when the New York City schools continue to be among the most segregated in the country. And New York City is really a highly segregated city still. In fact, when I was doing my nerding out today and doing some Googling, I came across a story in the Washington Post that referred to New York City, you know, as the capital of the Jim Crow North in the 50s, the 40s, 50s, 60s, you know, this myth that New York was this, you know, bastion of tolerance and integration, which I think a lot of people who even lived through it believe. And that New York, and this article mentioned today, the way that New York City is still like, you know, really highly, highly segregated part of the country.
Well, I mean, one of the
reasons. In a lot of ways. I mean.
Yes. Well, they want to believe it. I grew up in a white working class neighborhood in the Bronx. There was the black neighborhood. There was the Hispanic neighborhood. And we all came together. And the reasons I felt very strongly, by Russell Friedman and I, my co-creator, felt very strongly about setting it in the North is because we feel that the North always gets a pass when you're looking at the struggle in the 1960s. And the shows and movies are set as more often than not, of course, in the South. Now, the South was a nightmare. It was, you know, it was like bordering on a fascist state in terms of the segregation of things that are done. But, you know, as Rosalind was saying, the North was also segregated. And you can't, you know, let that, you have to understand where it was all over and how the different forms it took.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's a great point, and I've seen you mention that, you guys, in other interviews that you've given to other outlets about the show, the importance of setting this in the North. And also, like, you know, I mean, as a writer, you're from the North. You didn't live that in the South, so it might not be as so true for you to write something. You know, you got to write from what you know.
Well, you write what you know.
Yes, but we also, you know, part of the soul of Joyland is that people are divided, but people still come together. And people who you wouldn't, you know, Marty Dent and Lillian Bass are best friends, much to Tyra's unhappiness. but, you know, they're very different, but they were salt and pepper. And so whatever that, and they, you know, Marty's working class, Julian's middle class, but they're good friends. They have a love. And you even have, as you see in episode two, and it's going to be developing even more, the relationship between Red Harrison, the handyman at the bungalow colony, and Aaron Dent, you know, the fast-talking, you know, Jewish teenager who, you know, is struggling for some comfort as he struggles with the fact that he's realizing he might very well be gay. And, you know, you wouldn't think those two would have anything in common, but what you have to do when we tell stories is surprise people without being coming out of left field. And you have to show that there are so many doors to go through to reach other people. And I think sometimes we get so caught up in this very small landscape. It's, you can only connect to someone if it's you felt, you know, you check one or two boxes. I mean, nowadays you have to agree about politics, or, you know, I mean, or else forget it. You know, I mean, that's off the table. But there's so many ways, and I think that's an important message of, that we can come together.
I just want to switch the gear of the conversation for a moment. I want to ask Damone, what's it like directing a Zoom show?
thanks for having us on the show, first of all. What's it like directing? You know, I've been really fortunate in this season being COVID, where our industry has been shut down. I've been really fortunate to have been able to pivot into this virtual space.
Because you're really a stage veteran, right? The stage is really your thing?
The theater is where I live, but even in my work as a theater director, technology is always featured quite heavily. So the pivot wasn't as large for me as it has been for many of my colleagues. But I think the thing that's most interesting and the thing that we keep saying in the process is that we have to keep in the forefront of our mind that we're not replacing the theater. It's not a replacement for film or TV, but it is its own hybrid that demands its own kind of unique playing. Someone just responded today. They called me. They saw the episode and said, "You know I wasn't watching TV, but it hooked me. It drew me in, and it forced them." This is the direct quote. Like, there were certain things that I had to just put together in my mind. You know, we're used to, even now. I'm watching. Not in this moment, but I was watching an episode of one of my favorite TV shows, Girlfriends, which Friends knocked off. I'll tell you about that later. But Girlfriends, and we watch them, and they have this physical interaction, and they're able to touch each other and see each other. And in Zoom, we've got to create the space for the audience connections because we can't physically do them. But we have to lean into the story and lean into the telling of the story in a way that really allows the audience to fill in the blanks for the things that we couldn't physicalize. And it takes a lot of trust. You know, it takes a lot of trust in trusting the writer and trusting that the writer is writing at the center of honesty and authenticity, but leaving space for what this exploration demands, as opposed to what the demands of being on a film set or a TV set, or even working in the live theater. So it's a great challenge. It's fun. We get into the editing process, and we are up. We were just talking about this, Gary and I, earlier. You know, myself and our other colleagues, we're burning the midnight oil. We're editing. You know? But it's so much fun. It's like you go down this rabbit hole, and you see one thing, and then you see another thing, and one question leads to another before we actually land on a thing that we'll use to tell the story. But it's been really fun. It's been really great. And each episode is our second. We learn so much. We learn so much in how to tell this story. So, yeah, that was a long answer to that question, but...
but a good one.
Well, thank you.
So that made me think so Gary mentioned earlier that it was you really who recommended that you ditch the stage directions that were a big part of episode one.
Well,
I shouldn't say ditch, evolve.
Yeah, that's true. He was the one. This way, if it didn't work, we could blame him.
That's true. You know what? But it's that sense of trust. We had to trust that what Gary and Russell had written was strong enough. And that first episode, you know, you really, if you saw the first episode, we tried to spell out everything. And so the audience didn't have to engage it as intensely or as intensely. Another comment that I received was this, it was like, oh my gosh, finally I can just watch the thing straight through, just kind of engage it without you feeding me things. My brain could kind of create the images without you having to tell me. I can listen to the story and let the story unfold. And with what you've placed in front of me, I'm able to make other connections. I can make the connections. You don't have to spoon feed. And so when we started working on 102, I said, said to Gary, like, we've got to ditch the stage directions. We got to ditch them because we have to trust one, our audience is smart. We have to trust the power of what he's written, and lean into it. And so, and I think it paid off. I'm really pleased with this episode.
But there are a few occasions when I said, now, Damone, we really need that direction. Nope. Damone, nope. I said, you sure?
Nope. Nope.
Okay, I trust you. But are you sure?
Nope. But you know what? It's also the thing, too, that we have to keep reminding each other. Again, we're not on a film set. So the things that we're able to do on a film set or a TV set, we just can't do in this construct. And so we've got to find a way to honor what Gary has written while also honoring the kind of limitations of this construct. But let me say it this way, allowing what we can't do to push us deeper into a deeper level of creativity in how we tell the story. And not being precious to say, well, does this one image that might work in a live construct, does it really help the story? Does it really help move the story forward? Like, we have to just get to what's going to move the story forward seamlessly. And so that means, you know, in the theater we say, and this is a horrible thing to say, but I'm going to say it, you know, you have to learn how to kill your babies, you know. Mm-hmm. Gary has gestated with these thoughts and these scripts for a long time, and then we get into editing and go, yeah, no.
Yeah, I know when in the editing, Tamon would say, I'm sorry, I have to be with something. Oh, no, here it comes. Oh, no. But then towards the end, I was following your lead. I said, you know, we really should cut that.
Cut whole scenes, right? Everybody. Cut whole scenes.
Yep.
We have to remind ourselves in the theater, in film, in TV, in this kind of hybrid construct, here's the one thing that remains constant. The play is the thing. The play is the thing. And so we all have to remove ego and pride and self and go, okay, what's the best way we can serve this play, this story? Because that's what ultimately has to take center stage. And we've been good. Listen, this is episode 2, and I would be lying to you. So, and it's easy, and, you know, it's not without protest or, you know, like, but that's part of the creation of the thing, right? So, but we look at it and we go, wow, okay, that was worth it. It's good. It's good. And people are responding. I just saw a comment that someone said, oh, my God, I can't wait for episode 103. So, you know, it's doing what it needs to do.
May 24th.
May 24th? That's kind of the best comment you can get, right? Someone can't wait to see the next. When, like, if you're at the mercy of online comments, they're – sometimes it seems the only people who take the time to comment are the bad comments.
Yes.
Yeah. And I haven't seen any bad ones yet.
No.
So that's good.
People really expect that we're trying something different.
Yeah. There was a newspaper article, I think we were in the New York Post, And the one thing is like, oh my God, they did it all on Zoom. Like, can you believe it? Can you believe they did this on Zoom? And again, that's the comments that I'm getting today. You know, like, I forgot about my computer. I had another friend who said flashed it from his computer to his large screen TV, and he was like, "Wow, this is really cool." So I'm really stoked. I'm pleased.
That's great. AJ, are you, I know AJ.
No, I'm still here.
Writer.
I've been listening.
I don't know if you have any more.
Can I just brag on our cast for a moment?
Oh, go for it.
And we have Roz here. Roslyn, I keep doing this.
It's okay. A lot of people call me Roz. I just never introduce myself that way, but you can call me Roz.
I'm always trying to, because people are quick to, like, shorten my name, too, and I'm like, hey, now, you know, give it a few years before you do it, whatever. Roslyn is pretty incredible, but this entire cast, we put this together. Here's the other thing that people don't believe. It's like it's a breakneck pace that we've set for ourselves to put this thing together. And talk about generosity and just, it's the yes and kind of spirit, you know. Roslyn, of course, our friend Tara Connor Jones. We had a friend, Allison Mahoney. We had a really last-minute change in our cast, and we called on this brilliant actress friend of mine. Brilliant actress, let me tell you, she did it. And she was 7 months pregnant, and she has COVID. And she jumped in and killed it, nailed it. So it's, I just have to shout out, you know, everyone in this cast, Ellen Adair and Darren Lorenzo, and there's not a bad one in the bunch. So that makes the
and they're in London. We have Michelle Fahrenheim. You know, talk about the 5-hour time difference when we rehearse.
Yeah. Yeah, we've got people in London. I think we had someone in California.
Two people, yeah.
Yeah, so we're all over the country.
Florida.
Florida, yep.
Chicago.
Yep. My hometown, Chicago, yep.
Yeah.
So it's
incredible.
It really is a labor of love that these people come together, many of them returning from episode 101. So we're really honored for all of them for their contributions and just for their tenacity in getting it done.
Actually, that makes me think, if I can, could I jump in and ask a question? AJ, was that you? You want to jump in?
Yeah, I just got one quick question.
Sure.
Did you guys put out, speaking of the cast, did you guys put out a casting call, or did you guys like say, hey, I know people, you know, I know this person, I know that person, and put out calls to people and see if they wanted to do it, or was it a casting call?
Dean is a genius. He called in about 98% of the cast. I think I brought maybe two people, maybe, I don't know. I think Gary put together this whole cast.
A lot, yes.
I think Gary put I'm sitting here thinking, like, my friend Tara came on board, but Gary, not Gary Shanley, but Gary Morgenstein. This is Gary Morgenstein show.
No. And you know what about, and this is the beauty when you work and when you collaborate. So Tara Connor Jones had one, DeMont got her because she was a teacher. And she's now an actress. And for just a very small part, I mean, I think in episode 102, Tara has maybe two or three lines, right, Damone? But she is so wonderful. She inspired me that I'm bringing her. She's back in episode 103, and she has more of a relationship with Tyra because she's – that's the magic of it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Just someone just hits it, and you go, wow, or Eric Rausch. who plays John Kelly. Now, originally, I'll tell you, originally the role of John Kelly was for someone like 20-ish. And when then I thought of Eric, and Eric is a wonderful actor, but on screen he's a little weird, and he gets a compliment.
And it works.
Right? He's like, oh, shit. I mean, whoa,
yeah.
Right? And he rips off his T-shirt. It's like, whoa.
Yeah. I mean, listen, we were all, like, my direction to him when they're talking about the integration of the schools or when they're talking about doing this benefit for Red, like, this makes you lose your mind. Go. And he started flailing about and taking off his shirt. Like, I didn't come up with that. I didn't say, now at this moment, you're going to take off your shirt. He flipped out. He flipped out to a space where it was like, I got a shirt off. And, oh, God, this is ranting. Perfect. Let's just let it keep rolling and just see how long he's going to do this. you know? And we got some great stuff from it. I have to also say, too, though, what I'm most pleased about in terms of the casting, in terms of our whole process, is that, again, our industry has been shut down for over a year. And though we may not be able to pay people, you know, like we can't pay, like, it is an opportunity to flex muscles that have been literally forced into a kind of dormancy, you know, and that we're able to create space and a platform for people to thrive and to utilize their gifts and their skills. These actors have shown up. They've shown up. It's a testament, certainly, to what Gary and Russell has written, what they have written. But it is also, I think, and maybe Roslyn, you can speak to this. It's a space where we can breathe, and it's kind of familiar to be back in the woodshed. But would you think so, Roslyn?
Oh, yeah, I totally agree. I've been very grateful for having these types of projects to keep my muscles, you know, strong and, you know, making on-the-fly choices and, you know, taking direction and, you know, all of those sorts of things. Because, I have self-tape. I have a lot of commercial self-tape, but I do sometimes have a real legit scene to do. And I don't feel like I'm coming from a place of, oh, God, I haven't done this in weeks whenever it happens. I'm like, okay, I got this. I know what to do. I can make a strong choice, you know. let's do this. And, yeah, so I don't feel as panicked, I think, as some of my friends are about things possibly reopening because they haven't been doing this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah,
go ahead.
No.
Well, that's the question I kind of wanted to ask Roz about, as an actor, and so much of your performance, you may be accustomed to having that relationship with your scene partner and reacting to that person. And, you know, now I assume these things that I see where two characters in the scene, you shoot them together on Zoom, right? You're reacting against somebody on Zoom, but there's a lag sometimes and whatever, and your director, so I don't really know where the director is while you guys are performing. Are you on the phone? Are you also on Zoom?
Damone is the voice of God. He's just a voice. He'll hide his camera. Sometimes he'll pop on if he needs to demonstrate something because there's like technical aspects that we played with more in this episode about people like entering scenes and that sort of thing. But he's in general kind of giving direction to Shesha's voice.
Yeah.
I thought of Joyland today. I don't know if you listened to Fresh Air today. Stephen Colbert was the guest today being interviewed by Terry, what's Terry's name? Terry, why am I forgetting the name of the great
Terry Gross.
Working in America
Terry Gross.
Today? Terry Gross. Terry Gross is interviewing Stephen Colbert, and he talked about doing the show from home he's not on Zoom, he's got a little home studio, but about doing the show home alone with only his family, and he talked about how much better he is if he tapes while his wife is sitting in a little chair across from him and being a one-person audience. And he says, if you watch the show, you can tell the shows that he has to tape by himself and the shows where he's got one person, his wife, watching him. And you hear her laugh sometimes.
Yeah.
It makes a difference. It makes a huge difference. Even directing, like I have the fortune of having this great system in Jersey City, so I can see them in a wider construct than, you know, sitting at my laptop. And even the difference of that, having this system where I can see them in a wider sense, or when I'm stooped in front of my tablet, you know, it makes a difference. I feel closer to them when I can see them in a wider, from a wider perspective. So even just in terms of the environment of Zoom itself and the different ways to see it, you know, watching on your phone, looking from your tablet, having whatever kind of system that allows them to kind of be larger than life, it all makes a difference to having someone there in the room as a performer, even if it is just that one somebody, you know. So my hat goes off to this cast. Again, Rosalind and all of them, just because it's not easy. It's not easy, but they make it look easy.
And they have chemistry, which is astonishing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean like Kyra and Julian and Jameel, you know, Jameel Dobson, they're married. Does anyone doubt that they're married? And how do you guys do that? It's just incredible.
I was thinking about that. I actually watched it this afternoon. I'm getting my nails done, as one does. and I was like, I had so many thoughts about how great it looked and how it moved at a quicker pace than the first episode. But yeah, a lot of those scenes were, it's like they're working so well. They're working so well, and I've never met Jameel. You know, we're just kind of, I guess, just trusting each other and just going for it.
Yeah, but you look like you guys have had all the drinks and cocktails and hung out to create this, this cool relationship. It really does. It really does. So, again, it's this crew, this cast, man. It's their gift. Their gift. Yeah. Even you and Tara in your scene, Rosalind, in your office with her. Miss Fan, we got your boys. I said, they just look like they've been chilling and hanging out and working together for years. They got a language. They've got a rhythm. They've got signs. And, you know, I'm like, huh? And they don't know each other. Yeah,
I've been doing a lot of online only stuff like this. I have an improv group that I'm a part of that I've never met any of them, and it's going to be so wild when things open back up. And I'm like, oh my gosh, it's you!
I can touch you.
Yeah, exactly.
Have you been vaccinated yet? Okay, I can touch you.
exactly.
I keep joking with Gary and Russell and Paul. I keep saying, boy, I can't wait till episode 106 when we can shoot on location.
Yes. And I can write a scene where people kiss.
Yes.
Oh.
For Lori in the alley.
Was she really kissing like somebody, or what was up with that?
That was her boyfriend. All right, Damone, we have to tell Karen and AJ and everyone. So, Lori, Kathy Saunders, the actress, her boyfriend was over, and she said, "Oh, he's happy to do it."
Yeah. Well, because the scene required, so we were kind of breaking our neck because Lori is being flirtatious, you know, and making Aaron is crazy jealous now, and so we've got to, how can I paint this picture, you know, we have to see this, of her jumping over Aaron to this just available body in the restaurant, right, And so she said, my boyfriend's here. I said, he's hired. All we need is their lips. That's it from him.
And, so she's not going to pay anybody. It was pretty easy.
Yeah, boy, yeah. Did they, I was like, her father used to like me until this moment.
That was pretty good, the way he was sort of like out of the screen, and you could just see like the little sliver of him on the left there.
Yep, just enough. I mean, but it's finding those kind of moments. The moments with Edna and Red, there was a moment where it felt like we tried everything, Rosalind. It felt like we tried every possible thing to make it look like they could kiss. Like, let's stop it. We're not on a film set. We're not on a TV set. How do we create this kind of intimacy? And we learned that just a lean in and that sense of passion in your eyes, because the same, this is true soon as it is for the film. And the story has to rest in the eyes, and the camera will do the rest. Right? And we learned that that much is true for Zoom. You lean into that camera. Allow the story to in your eyes. And we don't need to physically see you kiss. We see that in our own mind's eye. We feel that. You know, when Rosalind is from one moment being pissed at her husband to the next moment they're able to laugh. It's that twinkle in the eye that helps you make the transition. Right?
Sometimes our imagination is even better than what we could possibly see.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we have to trust you for that. We have to trust our audience that their imagination is vivid, just as vivid as ours is.
All right. Well,
yep.
As much as I would love to do this all night, we have to unfortunately move on. You guys are more than welcome to come back next month after
Please,
the next episode premieres. Gary, a pleasure as always. And Rosalind and Simone, great talking to you guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
It was great to talk to you guys. A real treat. Thanks. And
what's
the date, Gary, of the next episode? May what?
It's going to be May 24th, so we better start rehearsing very soon.
Tomorrow. See you tomorrow, Rosalind. You're called at 5 o'clock.
Oh, God. I have time for it.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you.
Thanks, you guys.
Sleep well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good night.
Bye-bye. That was really fun.
Yes, it was. Always is every time we have Gary on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Gary could, Gary used to co-host another podcast on NDB Media. He was on, what was it called? Monday Night in America, right?
Yeah.
And you can tell, Gary could talk for the whole 2 hours of our show. Of his own show.
Yes.
He just has too many things going on.
So
all right.
Without Jamie, did you want to talk anything about Van Helsing or Fear real quick, or did you just want to wait for her next week and double up a little?
I can wait for her. Fear the Walking Dead was a fairly middling episode this week. It was a fairly average episode where something happened but nothing happened. We can table that, I think. And Van Helsing, you know, so it was an episode in which there's a lot of mistrust and Daniel. It was nice that it focused on Daniel, but it involved him possibly having some memory lapses and some dementia-like symptoms. Or he could be a total liar, right? Like, who knows on this show.
That explains the conversation with Jamie asking about season one.
Yeah, and so in this episode, Daniel mentions that you might remember when you're still watching the show when they were fighting over control of the dam, and, you know, Daniel, there's a scene where Daniel is sort of in a standoff and maybe going to shoot Victor, and he brings up, he's like, well, Victor, you shot me in the face, and I still have pain every day about it, and so Jamie had sort of forgotten how that all went down.
Gotcha.
But yeah, Daniel may or may not be having a mental break. And yeah, Jamie was asking all about when he had that sort of mental break at the ranch a couple years ago.
Yeah.
So it was a little frustrating. It's interesting and yet sort of ground we've covered and whatever, right? So Jamie and I can rehash that. And Van Helsing, I mean, even Jamie texted me that she was frustrated with Van Helsing, which continues to be mired in its time travel plot right now, where, you know, a character travels to the past to tell us the origin story of the villains that I don't care about in the first place. So it was a little. And,
you know,
and,
actually,
you know, Trisha,
it's funny. Yeah. I was hearing you guys talk about Van Helsing, and you know what I kept thinking about with the whole time travel thing? You know what I can see happening? Is them messing with time travel is what's going to cause the rise of the vampires in the first place. It's going to be
yeah,
one of those chicken and
probably,
egg things.
Right? Mm-hmm. Like trying to stop the Dark One from rising is going to be what caused it. Like, this
created,
is something
yeah.
that was very, that was, this was a, something that was covered very well in Continuum, right? And not so well in 12 Monkeys, but decently in 12 Monkeys about, like, if you try to mess with, and many shows, if you, you know, the whole, like,
yeah.
should I kill Hitler kind of business, right?
Right. 12 Monkeys got very convoluted.
It, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it had some good things going on, and then it got convoluted. But we've seen this, that this sort of, like, self-fulfilling prophecy, that if you go to the past and try to stop something, you're the person that's going to cause it to happen.
Yeah.
Like, maybe Hitler would have just kept, I think we saw it on, I don't know, I saw it so recently, like, could Hitler have just remained, like, being a failed art student and then somebody goes back in time to stop him and then causes him to become Hitler? Yeah. It's, so I can see that happening, yeah. So, yeah, Jamie and I are both a little frustrated with that, Jamie less so than I, but we can, that's it. I've already talked about it enough. We can talk about it next week.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you want to talk about the show you keep falling asleep during?
Great, yeah. Let's see if I can stay awake long enough in our conversation to talk about
it. Talk about it.
I thought it was incredibly boring this week. I fell asleep
I can,
again.
If you want, I can sum the show up in about 30 seconds.
Go.
It was the Groundhog Day version episode. There you go. That's all you need to know. I think actually the most interesting.
You only needed like 3 seconds to do that. Yeah.
I know. Actually, the most interesting part that happened was we actually found out a little more about Maddox, and apparently his son isn't handicapped. He was in a car accident with his wife, and apparently she was driving and blames herself for causing the accident. So his son is injured from an accident. I guess he got brain damage from it.
Yeah, I found that very frustrating. Can you hear me?
Still there?
I found that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me? I found that
yep.
storyline quite frustrating. Cause okay, here's the thing: it really irritated me that I got so much more emotional character development from Maddox, the villain, and I still get none from Brian. And minimal from Finola, and this is an episode that by the end of the episode, I'm expected to believe that this incredibly powerful bond exists between our two main characters, right? And that Brian's got these like really intense feelings of I don't know what they are. If they're friendship, love, if they're
it's gotta
partner
be friendship.
Love, whatever. Yeah, I think so.
Well,
I
here's the funny thing. Here's the funny thing about it. When he says that line. He still looks bored.
He does.
And I always say he looks like he'd rather be anywhere but where he is. He really, at that moment, he actually for once really wanted to be somewhere other than from where he was.
Yeah. Yeah. He really looks like he doesn't want to be on this show. Yeah, it really frustrated me that I get this, like, incredibly, like, in-depth emotional development of Maddox in a way that really seems to have no bearing on the storyline. Like, it's, like, I mean, maybe it's kind of a point. I don't want to say it's, like, gratuitous character development. Maybe it will go somewhere. But we get this incredibly emotionally painful thing for him. And I'm sorry, but Fanol's father died and came back to life, and she doesn't have that emotional reaction. Right?
Yeah.
And Brian has this devotion to Maddox that is yet unexplained. And now he's got like a devotion to his partner, which is not on the screen.
Unexplained.
And it's a devotion, you know, it's a devotion. So I guess I see it as like a Scully and Mulder level of thing where, you know, they were so
close. But it's not there.
Close, you know, but it's not there. It's not on the screen, right? Like, I don't see it. And so it really bothered me that they invested so much in they've invested so much in Maddox for like, I don't know why. And other characters like don't have it. So I found that very frustrating. And I was like, why are they showing me this? Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And, it, you know, and then of course you have your funny montage moment where he has all these different partners. And actually, the one part of Grace that I recognized her and I couldn't place her and I didn't look to see what I know her from, but that kind of drove me nuts. Because she actually had, you know, it seemed like she had the biggest role of all his alternate reality partners.
Well, she says,
I feel like,
she says, I've been your partner for 5 years. And I'm like,
yeah.
Oh, so he's only been like Manola's partner for like less than 1 year, I think, right?
2 minutes. yeah.
2 minutes, yeah. I mean, granted, 5 minutes doesn't matter if you can't remember it. But, I mean, that was the other thing about this is that for most of the episode, we're seeing like this like passing through multiple reality, like to every time. So we learn that every time is a different reality. It's not even like a, it's the many universes theory fringe type thing, right? Which makes sense because Wyman. But it's not like a time traveling thing. But it's all really the many realities seen through the bull, whatever that boy's name is. So he's not a villain, but, you know, the guy that, the jumper.
Yeah.
The kid that. And then in the second half of the episode, we start to see that all through Brian. So I guess we don't see it, but I guess we have to assume that Brian then also jumps time after time after time.
Yeah, which how? He has no connection to the debris. This kid has to go in the lake to get to the debris to make this all happen. So what? Because Jesus, what the hell is the father's name there? I'm blanking.
The father, George.
I don't know his father.
George.
So because George tells Brian, you have to remember. You have to remember that makes you jump when you have no like.
Yeah.
It was an awful script. I'm sorry. I have wanted to give J.H. Wyman the benefit of the doubt, but this is bad. This is, and it's not getting any better. And you know, honestly,
no,
I feel like I would have liked to, like, you know, it's always so I feel like it's too centered on our main characters, and we continue to learn nothing about them. Whereas I would have felt better if it wasn't so centrally focused on them in this episode and gotten a little more of the jumper. You know, like what he's doing and trying, you know, I don't know. I just, I feel like the episode was all over the place and it was a mess and we clearly didn't like it and we should move on.
Well, if I can complain about one more thing, it's yet another episode where we learn nothing about the debris and nobody makes any real effort to like retrieve or figure out the debris. Right. Like, in fact, one partner, that woman, I think her name was Grace, is like, we have to wait until the crew can get him and examine the debris. He's like, oh, no, I got it under control, which I guess he's going to jump again, which is what George said don't do. But really, maybe if you waited while the team retrieved the debris and examined it, like, you could figure it out, right? Also, this is a massive piece of debris, which is like the size of a jet engine that they swim through. And in other episodes, it's like one tiny little Dorito-sized piece that caught, like,
yeah, maybe it's the
hull
of the ship.
It's one of my major frustrations that we are learning nothing about. I mean, the debris is like a – so a MacGuffin is maybe not the right description here, but the debris is sort of meaningless. It's just there to, like, investigate
it's
what weird thing can, like, Joel Wyman dream up this week, right?
It's the episode tool. That's all.
Or J.H. Wyman,
It's the episode tool.
Yeah.
That's all it is.
Yeah.
Just to create the situation.
Yeah, we again learn nothing, and it's like whatever weird thing they can put the characters through without really it ever going anywhere in terms of what is the debris, what's happening, why is anyone. And for Brian to just, we have to assume that he yeah, whatever. Let's not talk about it anymore. It's bad. I think it's not getting any better. The numbers are holding steady,
no.
but they're kind of low. It's like the lowest
really?
Rated show on Monday. Well,
yeah, but,
they're holding
you know what?
They're holding
saying
steady
the numbers are holding
viewers.
Saying the numbers are holding steady on NBC isn't really saying much.
Yeah, yeah. They're holding steady at like 2 million, whereas like a CSI will draw like 9 million on a Monday night, right?
Yeah.
And then football will destroy it when football comes back. It better not be on during Monday Night Football because forget about it. So it's holding steady at what's acceptable for NBC, but it's bad. The music is bad too. The show is bad.
Yeah. I mean, I'll finish the season.
I won't watch a season two. If it gets renewed, I'm out. I'll finish the season out because we're covering it on our podcast, but I will not watch season two.
Honestly, I'd be surprised to get to season two, but stranger things have happened.
I will too. It's very bad. Everyone's in a bad mood all the time. All right, so let's move on.
Including us.
including us, yeah. If Jamie was here, she'd inject a little bit of positive, like,
yeah, that's not going to happen tonight.
No.
So, Big Sky.
Oh, my God, Big Sky. So my DVR failed to record the first 5 minutes, which at the end of last episode, both Jenny and Cassie were in like immediate mortal peril, and my DVR didn't record the first 5 minutes. When I turned it on, they both had already like escaped or whatever, or like Cassie was already like in jail.
So,
and I didn't even bother to go back and watch it.
I will fill you in. I was happy because Jenny, I actually remember last week I was complaining she didn't pull her gun. She just sat there. Well, when she stood up, she immediately pulled her gun on him. And then John Wayne showed up and was like, what's going on here? And he's like, Rand, go get out of here. He's like, I'm just having a little fun with her. And John Wayne was like, well, you know, just get out of here. And she gets out and everything. And he's like, so what you doing? She's like, I'm trying to help. What the hell's her brother? His brother's name?
Blake? Is his name Blake?
Blake, yeah. Yes, Blake. She's like, I'm trying to help Blake. I wanted to see, you know, if anything, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, well, you are trespassing. And she's like, yeah, I'm trying to help your brother. Screw your trespassing. So he's like, oh, I'm sorry. He's like, all you had to do was ask. I'll take you to the barn or house or whatever the hell.
Yeah.
Caretaker's place. I'll take you there myself. So they go, and then he leaves her there. He leaves her stranded.
Yeah, because they're all jerks.
And so leaves him stranded, and then Cassie, she finally shows her smarts. She calls the office answering machine, and starts saying, telling them I'm down, a few miles from the police station. We made a right, you know, she's like giving directions and stuff like, you know, she's like, this is the name of the sheriff, you know, of the deputy that arrested me, you know? And, he goes to get, they meet up with another car and he's getting her out of the car to hand her over to whoever the hell these people are. And she beats the shit out of him, even though she's handcuffed. But doesn't get away. He ends up hitting her in the head with a rock and knocking her out.
Ugh. So they
but
were going to kill
plan
her
worked.
Probably?
I don't know. Then they see that her
because
phone.
Because they
realize
she was recording,
yeah,
right?
So they,
the only reason
right,
they
realize that.
They realize.
Yeah, they realize she's recording. So he ends up bringing her back to the police, you know, to the sheriff's station where her new love interest comes and saves the day. I'm glad, though, that somebody in authority within the legal system actually does a pretty good job of believing them, even though they're only private investigators and not doing things exactly by the book, you know, as opposed to Sheriff What's-His-Nuts there who kept yelling at them.
Yeah, they're like, so. I mean, yeah, I do appreciate that. It is a little silly how they go around, like, shooting people all the time and breaking all these – I mean, they shoot more people than, like, Magnum P.I. did. And he shot a lot of people on that show. so, but I like liked that, and I liked how he actually, I mean, so there are a lot of, like, flaws in this episode, but I did really like that episode, that scene where he comes into the sheriff's office, and the sheriff is such a, you know, he's such a cartoon character of a small-town sheriff in a corrupt town, right? I feel like I've seen this, like, from
my
every cowboy
part,
movie since 1942.
Yeah, my favorite part is when the Fed says, no, this is the part when you answer the phone. And then the phone starts ringing.
The
governor's office. I was like, oh, that's awesome. I was like,
that was awesome.
That's amazing.
That was cool. And it made me want to know more about this character who's able to, like, call the governor to get this woman set free pretty quickly. For whatever reason, in a
you know what?
I'm not from Montana,
Marshals,
and I don't want to, like.
Marshals have a lot of power, though. Marshals are.
Yeah, they're feds. They're feds. They're not, I mean, they're, I guess they're sort of above the state system. They're feds, right? So they're not above the government, but they are above the state police. So that was pretty cool. I did like that. In general, I hate this season because these new characters, I think, are cartoon villains. They're so, this family is so ridiculously violent and dysfunctional. That I can't
except
believe
for Blake.
They've lasted this long.
Oh.
Except for Blake, who now is dead by the end of the episode, right? His brother killed him.
I
John
don't
Wayne
think he's dead.
Him.
I don't think
brother.
He's dead though. I
think
he
so?
I think he hit I think he bashed him pretty good, but I don't think he killed him. I could be wrong. But on first glance, I didn't think he killed
him. Only because Cheyenne saw it, right? And I feel like they're setting it up. While Cheyenne seems to be more reasonable. I think they're setting her up to
be
the most psychotic and like, she's got a plan. I think Cheyenne has a plan that she will inherit that ranch. Like, she's keeping her mother addicted to drugs, right? Like, she has the pills, and she gives them to her mother one at a time when she needs something from her. Is she trying to detox her, or is she trying to keep her on the pills?
Well, that scene with her mother, I mean, I think her entire intent there was she's trying to get her mother to fight back. And she, you know, she made her mother fight back against her, which is a step in the right direction because I think she wants to get rid of the father.
Oh, you know? She wants to kill the father. She wants the mother to kill the father.
Yeah.
I think she wants the
mother
to kill
what
the father.
I don't know what her entire goal is, but.
Well,
I mentioned last week that this is very reminiscent of Justified for me. That's what this season kind of feels like right now. But it's not justified.
Yeah.
It's not good.
No.
Like you said, they're too cartoony. It's too too obvious. You know, and justified, even though you knew who the bad guys were, they were very methodical and they weren't so open, you know?
Yeah. I think Cheyenne is the main. So there's an earlier scene where Cheyenne is talking to Blake. And he's like, you should just leave. I left and it was great. You should leave.
Yeah.
And she talks about dreaming of, like, leaving, but where would I go and being the white tiger? And then later with her mother, when she's giving the pills, her mother says, you've got to get out of here. And Cheyenne says, why would I do that? And I feel like Cheyenne is maybe the master of it all. She saw John Wayne strike Blake. I think he killed Blake because I think they set it up for Cheyenne to have this piece of information that no one else has.
Yeah.
Right now, it looks like she may be, like, one of the most dangerous people. Although Rand is, like, a complete, like, it looks like it was Rand who.
Rand's psychotic.
Lady.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know, though. I think in that one flash he had, I think John Wayne was there, too.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe John Wayne just covered it up.
Yeah, maybe John Wayne came in and stopped him and covered it up. But, like, they're allowing Blake to take the heat for it. Blake knows that. They all know it was Rand. Everybody except Blake knows it was Rand, right? I think the father knows. Blake.
Yeah, everybody knows.
John Wayne.
The father definitely knows.
And they're letting Blake take the fall because they're mad at him for leaving, because maybe it won't go as hard on him. I don't know.
Well,
why.
No,
but
he went against he went against Daddy.
They
set him up because he went against Daddy.
Yeah. And so Rand killed that guy Cole in the past. He assaulted Rosie. He attempted to assault Jenny. Yeah.
This guy Cole, Like, really? They can't come up with another name?
I know, right?
Cole immediately, I was like,
cousin,
I was like,
right?
Yeah. I was like, why is it Cole? I'm like, what the hell's going on here?
They only have, like, they can only use, like, four names on the show.
I guess. And
yeah.
John Wayne really, like, is that his name or a nickname? Like, they call him, I mean, he's got the hat and the gun.
I know.
I think it is, too.
It's so bad. The idea that there is this, like, I mean, it's such a hackneyed premise that there's this small town that's ruled by an evil ranching family. Like, didn't I see this in, like, isn't this, like, the theme of every, like, what, I mean, I want to say, like,
yeah.
The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance wasn't exactly this, but it was sort of this, like, it's always a town that, I mean, I think even Son of a Little House on the Prairie, where there's, like, a bad family and their bad son, and the whole town is, like, family down to them, right? And one good
little
man
house
has to stand up, right? I mean, seriously, we've seen this 1 million times. The only difference is that a good woman is going to stand up instead of a good man in this. It's and the characters are such cartoons. And speaking of cartoons, could we talk about Ronald?
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. Okay, that is the worst wig since Kerry Russell on The Americans. It makes The Americans wig look awesome. And those wigs were, like, kind of supposed to be bad. Oh, my God. Please, talk about Ronald while I compose myself for a moment.
Well, you know, it's funny. My first thought about that whole scene was they're just trying to showcase that she has a good voice, which they've done in another episode, too. So I was like, you know, and then to see Ronald in the crowd, I was like, are you freaking kidding me? And at first, Artie's like, no, maybe she's hallucinating. And I was like,
mm-hmm.
She's not hallucinating because she wouldn't know to hallucinate that awful wig. And he's like, oh, yeah, good point.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
I thought the same thing. I had the exact same process. I was like, oh, she's hallucinating. I'm like, no, wait, he's got the wig and the sweater. The sweater is so bad. Also.
Yeah. And then what made it worse was his girlfriend's just as nutty as he is.
So I'm a little torn on the issue of the girlfriend because – last week, I felt really like, let me not consider her, like, just because she is a little more adventurous in sex and Ronald's turned off by it, like, I don't want to condemn her. Like, let's not say she's crazy because she's not totally vanilla. But then this week, she's got, like, she's totally tasing him for a while. Like, yes, she's sadistic and dangerous.
Yes,
also,
she's
right?
not.
And it's kind of ironic that Ronald hooked up with like, he thought he was getting a mousy girlfriend and he's got this dangerous woman. Although, I think Ronald wants to be dominated, right? Like, his mother dominated him and he kind of needs to be dominated by a woman. I'm a little, in the early part, the first episodes, every time Ronald used that taser against his captive girls, it was like a devastating, debilitating shock they got, right? Like, sometimes they were unconscious afterwards. Can you turn it down?
He's
giving himself a baby.
Yes, I think it has different settings, but she's also, like, giving him a quick zap, whereas he was, like, holding it on them and, like, you know, type of thing.
Yeah.
She's just kind of like...
Yeah, I mean, okay, there's a little part of me that was like, okay, for a minute I was like, oh, maybe this ends where she kills him. And then I was like, no, it can't happen that way. It has
to end
with
that
Jenny
way.
And Cassie
no, they
got to
catch him.
Jenny and Cassie have to get him.
They got
to
catch him.
And then I figured, I guess maybe he'll have to kill her eventually, right? So maybe he'll kill her.
No, you know what's going to happen? She's going to be so in love with him when Jenny and Cassie do finally catch up with him, she's going to get in the middle of it.
She'll be like the girl that visits the killer in prison.
Yeah, they're going to be like, your poor dear, he's a killer. Stay over here. You know, like Jenny's going to have, like, her gun on him and be like, you're done, Ronald. And then girlfriend there is going to hit Jenny from behind the head.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, and try to save him.
It's coming.
Yeah, and become his. Yeah, you're right. You're right. That is what's coming. I'm a little... So I was very disappointed also with Ronald sneaking into the bar to hear Jenny Carrie sing because Okay, so apparently he only fled within a very short distance that he can drive to karaoke and get back at night to his girlfriend's house. Like, he only moved to, like, a couple towns away, apparently, right? I and Jamie are purely like, why is he not in Canada? Why is he not in Mexico? Why is he – apparently he's, like, right down the road. And also sleeping on his mother's grave, and these are just not things that a cold and calculating person can do. Now, they had the marshal this week say, oh, this shows that he has compulsions that he can't resist, and I'm eventually going to catch up. It really made me miss Legarski, which I can't believe I'm saying that, but he was a guy with a plan, and he had it all planned out, and he had these fail safes and had evidence and an extra phone and all this stuff, and he actually was, like, more of a – he was a better criminal than Ronald or any of the – whatever the Vander whatever family they're called, the cuckoo family down the road in whatever town, because they're all, like, completely deranged people. Like, I kind of like Legarski was a far better – foil for Jenny and Cassie, right? I'm really disappointed with, like, the crazy town aspect. Like, it was always
actually funny.
Crazy
they killed the best part of this monstrosity.
Yeah, they killed, like, the better villain who probably was, like, getting off this thing. And now it's just, like, it's so gonzo, but not in a campy and good way. Like, it's not gonzo in, like, an American Horror Story kind of way. It's gonzo in, like, a, are we supposed to buy this kind of way.
It's just, I don't know. I won't be watching season two.
I'm really disappointed. I just feel like these characters, particularly in Blaketown, are too crazy to be. They're just so violent and crude and cartoonish that they're not frightening to me in a way that they should be. Like, there's a way to make a ruling class of a town scarier than these people. Like, I can't believe these people haven't already all shot each other yet. Like the sister stabs the brother in the leg with a fork at breakfast, and it's like,
yeah,
that's
funny. Yeah.
Yeah, it was bad.
Yeah, that was funny, though. I enjoyed that when she stabbed him. And the father's like, apologize. She's like, he punched me. And he's like, I don't care. I'll talk to him later. You can apologize.
Well, and it was kind of infuriating how he's like, a woman needs to, like, you know her place or whatever kind of speech he gave her.
Yeah.
I think there's a very simmering rage inside her that we haven't really seen. Yeah, that's a reason why I think Blake is dead, because I think I think she might be the sort of big villain of them all that we don't know about yet.
Well, it wouldn't be the first time they took a familiar face and killed him right away.
Yeah, right? Yeah, I think Blake could be killed. They also need to kill Jenny Lovett.
We could also get flashbacks, but we'll get Blake flashbacks too, so he'll be on the show.
Yeah.
Just like Ryan Phillippe.
Also, him being killed gives Jenny, like, a greater reason. Like, whereas there's a good reason now for them to give it up and go home. Like, okay, Cassie was almost killed. You were almost killed. Give it up, go home. But if Blake is killed, that gives her the reason to be like, no, I have to stay and see this through. So, anyway, I think we only have, like, 4 more episodes left to watch.
I don't even remember how many episodes we have, so...
I think they got 6 more. Maybe they got 6 more in this week, too. So
I don't remember.
4 more to go.
I don't remember what the total number was. Well, we got 3 episodes. We had 2 episodes last week.
Oh, yeah. And we have 2 next week, right? Oh, no. It's Manifest has 2 next week.
Yeah.
Right. We had 2, so now we're 3, so we got 3 to go. All right.
Yeah.
So wasn't that a good segue, speaking of 2 episodes coming?
So Manifest.
Manifest. There are so many questions. This show is sort of really...
It's good and bad. It's the best.
Yeah.
It's the best of what we're watching, but there is some stuff that's kind of... I know. It's weird. Like you said, in the text, the show's kind of gone from them surviving to magic.
Yeah.
So
it feels like magic now, right?
Which you know what's funny? I thought about it this week watching it, and I don't know why we never thought of this before, because the shadows, the meth heads, we know they
mm-hmm.
died and came back
right.
to life.
Right.
So as soon as that happened, we should have been like, oh, okay, well that makes they were brought back to life. And my theory about the whole redemption thing, that's totally a thing. I think Nick Michaela might even said something about that this week, about the redemption.
Well, if you follow the calling, that is your redemption, maybe not.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the callings do seem to, in general, lead you to make somebody else's life, save a life, basically to save a life, right?
Yeah.
The question is, like, not everyone is in equal need of redemption. So a person like Zeke was in need of redemption because he was a drug addict who sort of like fell away from his family because he was guilty. He felt bad.
Well,
he didn't really need to be redeemed, but
sister.
He couldn't forgive himself
right.
really for that, right? And Michaela
yeah.
couldn't forgive herself for, you know, Evie's death. And
well, it was
like,
kind
I
of
don't really know
fault.
Why. Okay, all right, but Cal doesn't need redemption. Ben doesn't need redemption. Did Fonzie need redemption?
Well,
now the meth head needs redemption.
I don't know.
Maybe
we just don't know what Ben. Cal, yes, I have a redemption for Cal, but it's a different kind of redemption. His cancer.
All right, but it's.
I know.
Okay,
I know. I'm just. Maybe I'm stretching.
Fonzie beat his cancer. Kind of scientific. I mean, the thing is, every single person on the plane, it appears, has callings, right? Every single person who dies in
yes.
the sack has callings, but they don't all equally require redemption. Do they all have an equal opportunity for redemption? Can a person like Jace get redemption? Now, that guy
no.
who crashed into the river couldn't be redeemed, but he only had 3 days. Like, other people have 5 years, right? Like, why do some people get 3 days and some people get 84 days and some people get 5 years?
It's because of how long they were missing.
Yeah, but,
or dead.
But we don't know why the plane back, so why couldn't the plane come back in 3 days or 84 days? Like, why did they get
I don't. I don't know, because they needed that much time to complete their mission.
I know. It's just a big question. Like, it's a thing
well,
that
yeah.
I don't, and I also don't get the tail fin, right? So we had a lot about the tail fin in this week's episode. And then the tail fin leads to other things in this episode, right?
Yeah.
So before I list my 1,000 questions about that, how do you feel about Vance right now?
I think Vance is just making the best of the situation because Ben went and screwed it up.
He did. Vance does not
now,
want the job.
Here's my question, though, speaking of Vance, and maybe I missed something or forgot something. But did we know that Vance knew that Sanvi killed the major?
Yes. He's the first call. She
okay.
called him. He's the person she called.
She called him. Okay.
And he...
I couldn't remember.
So I think this business with the sanitation truck, Vance sent them to pick up the body, right?
Right. That's right. Oh, my God. I completely forgot that. Thank you.
I think she called Vance, and Vance cleaned it up. So I think where
yes.
Jared is chasing, why was this trash truck around? Oh, because the NSA sent them to clean up the body. I think that's what that is, right?
Okay. Yep. Yes, yes. I believe you are correct. Thank you. I completely, uh-huh. yeah. I had a dumb moment.
Yeah. Yeah, you remember that. I'm a little worried that there's a way in which Vance feels like he's right back in. I just got that feeling in this episode that he's right back in it. I don't really believe that. I think Vance is a good guy. And I think if this
yeah.
operation existed, it's better to have Vance in charge of it than someone else, right? Like this
oh God,
turns
yes.
out this was an existing government operation. So at least we got Vance in charge of it.
Yeah. And Sanvi's going to be part of it now too, because he gave her a lab coat and a key card.
Yeah, but how does like, I'm worried about Sanvi in that situation. Like, how has Sanvi not become the guinea pig that they want to experiment on? She was on the plane. Like, okay, in terms of science, it's ridiculous that you'd allow.
She doesn't have the callings anymore, though.
They don't even know about the callings. The government people don't know about it except for Vance, right?
Yeah.
Is that public knowledge, the callings?
Yes,
you know
kind
about
of, sort
them.
Of. Kind of, sort of,
I
because
mean,
remember then, the major's daughter was specifically looking for Michaela to help find her mother.
Yes. So let me put a theory out here. Could she actually not be the daughter but be an operative? Like, do you think the major even had a daughter, or do you think that's all made up because she's, like, part of the whole major business?
I think that there's got to be something more to it, because I don't understand, if your mother is part of the government like this and you have a daughter, they can spin some yarn about how your mother died, because she has no idea that her mother's dead. How does she not
right.
know? How is NSA not telling the daughter, hey, we're sorry, but your mom's dead?
Well,
you know what I mean? Like,
because Vance was off.
No, they
Vance
do know.
Not in it.
No, they do know, because the one that what's Vance's buddy there that you
Powell?
Don't like?
Powell knows, and so does his.
Yeah, Powell and his boss mentioned it about the major being dead.
So they know. They know. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I just,
so,
I don't know.
I kind of
was wondering, like, could she be part of the major's, like, operation trying to figure out what happened? You think she's a robot?
I think so. No, I think she's part of the operation, because if she's a real daughter, she would know her mother's dead. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so I kind of like that storyline because it gives Jared a reason to exist, because if Jared...
Yeah.
If there's not going to be a love triangle anymore, then why is Jared on the show? And so this gives him a thing to do and puts him into, like, conflict with Michaela in a way that he's not even aware of yet.
Yes.
And maybe this is a way that he, you know, he stays in the mystery or whatever.
I agree.
Instead of just getting rid of him like other people's boyfriend, like everybody else's boyfriend just gets written off the show. Especially if you're in the Stone family. So, I don't know. I have a lot of questions about this tail fin. And then we find Kelly Taylor's body is being kept in a giant alien-style test tube downstairs, right?
Yeah.
And this business where her body, which has been dead for a year and a half now, is reverting to being like it was underwater for like 7 years, right? So there's a bunch of things I don't get about this. So why did the tail fin bloop itself to the ocean, but the whole rest of the plane didn't? Right? They've got the whole plane there. The whole plane blew up in New York City, but the tail fin blooped itself to Cuba.
I don't have an answer to that. But I also want to know.
Why did the body bloop there?
I don't know, but. All I know is the death of the major, the death of the meth heads, the tail fin, and I feel like there was one other thing that all happened simultaneously.
The death of the major, the meth heads, the
okay, it all happened at the same time.
Tail fin. Yeah, one other thing happened also.
What?
It was the resurrection.
I forget
of the
what
meth,
the other thing
not
was.
The death, right? It was the resurrection of the resurrection of the meth heads. The
No, because the resurrection of the meth heads didn't happen until the first
right.
episode this season, which was like 3 months later. It was the death of the meth heads, the death of the major, and the tail fin blooping. I feel like there was one more thing.
And the resurrection of Zeke happened at that moment also, right? When the meth heads die, when they go in they all fall in the lake together, but Zeke comes out and lives. The glowing light.
Right. All right. Actually, hold on.
Right.
So
I think that's all what happens simultaneously.
Yeah.
They die,
yeah. Yes. Zeke. Yeah. I actually have it written down. Zeke. surviving, the Shadows dying, the Major dying, and the Tailfin Blue.
Yeah. So I have one more question. So Ben touched the Tailfin, and he has a glowing hand now that apparently, like, leads him to mysteries, right? The glowing hand led him to Kelly's dead body.
Yeah.
And they go, he and Vance go inside the secret room, the fishbowl, whatever it is, for him to touch the thing again, and, like, nothing happens, although occasionally his handprint glows. So I just can't believe that the minute Sanvi walks in there, they're not like, hey, Sanvi, why don't you touch it? Like, why doesn't even Ben say, hey, Sanvi, you touch it and see what happens? I mean, I know Sanvi lacks the genetic
marker, you know,
now, but she's still a plane survivor.
That's a good question, because you're the only smart person watching the show, because I didn't think of that either.
Oh, you would have thought of that. I know she lacked the genetic marker and she cured herself, but I feel like the show has really gotten away. Like last season, Sanvi was pursuing a scientific solution, but this season is magic. It appears to be a glowing hand. I'm sorry, that's magic, right?
Yeah.
So,
I
think
it's
like, hey, Sanvi,
interesting.
Touch it.
And I kind of like the way they've steered it towards Egyptian mythology.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of like that aspect of it.
Well, yeah, that is kind of cool. And I don't know if it's real Egyptian mythology, because I haven't read up on it, but I assume it is. It sounds good.
Oh, yeah. Everything they've talked about so far is actual mythology, and they've just made some tweaks to it, like with having the peacock feather instead of the ostrich feather. They've made some tweaks that have, you know, they're questioning. They're like, why is this?
I agree with you. I really like that. I like the way, like, the more research they do, it seems like all this has happened before in history, and, it, you know, it's not unprecedented. This is a thing, and they can maybe figure it out. I like that. I mean, you and I know both kind of like that sort of, you know, that sort of historical grounding in mythology or whatever feels a lot like a lot of the Lost stuff we did. And other, I know Alyssa really loves mythology and Egyptian mythology and stuff like that. And it appeals to people like us who enjoy these, like, mystery box kind of shows.
So switching gears a little, Zeke seems to be an empath now.
Yeah, Troy on steroids now.
There you go.
And not just that he can feel it. He can feel, like, people's feelings, but he seems to have a real innate instinct in how to diffuse it. Like, every time he talks to Beverly, he knows exactly what to say to like.
Yes.
He takes in her feelings, but he also can talk her down. And there's that little kind of, like, wah-wah thing on the screen that happens when he feels it, right?
Yeah.
Kind
of like a wave.
Like sort of.
It's like a wave of emotion.
Kind of wave. Yeah, like a wave. It looks like kind of like a sound wave depicted, but like a wave of emotion. You're right. So he doesn't have callings anymore, but is that – maybe that's really a calling still?
I think so. I think it's an evolution of the – because he survived his death date, because he did whatever he needed to do to survive it, his redemption, as it were, I think the empathic ability is an evolution of the calling.
So do you think if Pete survives,
as
the show ends, Pete has like 3 days or something, right, before his death date?
Yeah.
I assume he'll survive, right?
Yeah.
Do you think he'll become an empath, or he'll have another superpower?
I don't know that it's necessarily all going to be empathic. I feel like it's going to be more in tune with Pete for, you know, like, wherever his power ends up being, I think it's going to be more in tune with who Pete is, you know?
Well,
like,
so
part
far
of Zeke's
all he
problem.
Does is snivel and cry.
Yeah, well.
I mean, could we look back on the show last season and be like, yeah, Zeke was pretty empathic already? Or, I don't know, whatever he was. But, yeah, it's still like a calling, right?
Yeah. Yeah, in a way.
I mean, so at the end of the episode, Ben is like, we died and we came back. Like, Ben is full on believing in, like, some would call it magic, some would call it religion, but he's believing in, like, a resurrection afterlife kind of thing, right?
Well,
so,
you know what the great thing is?
Angels?
Ben's kind of the man of science, man of faith, because Ben has always been, you know, even though he comes from a religious background, Ben has never really been a religious person. So the fact that he's even considering this, I think it's, you know, he's kind of just going all in on everything. Like, no matter how crazy it seems, which I kind of like, because a lot of shows, you know, like this, the characters still fight the, what's happening. And Ben has just gone all in.
Well, Ben
I kind of like that
for a long time, though. Well, Ben is always like, let's study it, let's research it. Ben is also always like, trust the calling, Michaela, just trust the calling, just follow it. Don't question it, just do it. Yeah.
I think Ben gets off on this stuff. I think he really enjoys his life now, and with Grace out of the way, shit.
I know. Wouldn't you be glad if Grace went away for 84 days? There was a 2-month time jump in this episode, right? Like there was 84 days, and then there was like 7 days, and they've been gone for... You know, 2 months ago, it was like, can we just keep Cal out of the way of these killers for 84 days? And they seem to have gone, like, 79 days now. And all of a sudden, they're like, the killer's going to find Cal. Ah! Like, all of a sudden, he's going to been gone. I was surprised to get the time jump, but I was glad. Like, I did not want to watch 84 days of these scumbag methods, right, going around being, especially Jace, who has become, I mean, talk about a cartoon character.
Yeah.
Like, Jace went from... mid-level drug dealer, sort of general bad guy, to being this sort of psychotic nutcase who last week was like cutting out Michaela's eyes in a picture, right? It's not really clear why he or even Corey would follow him. Like, Corey converted this week also, right? Like, this week, the whole thing with the coach, which we haven't even talked about because the mystery of the week is kind of boring. Corey also was like, I don't want a guy to get killed. Corey was going to participate in killing a child, but this week he's like, I don't want to kill our coach who abused us years ago.
Corey wasn't really down with killing Cal either. They're just so afraid of Jace, which...
Yeah. And I guess when you see a giant ticking clock with your time running out, maybe you're like, okay, I should, like, do something. maybe I'll try to redeem myself. It was sort of an awesome calling that you just see a clock ticking down. You're 84 days. So after all that criticism, I'm going to say I think this show is about as good as it's ever been right now. It's pretty good.
Yeah, I think.
For Madison,
I've enjoyed.
It's no Lost.
Yeah.
But
no, I mean, we had a lot of complaints early on in season one. I feel like it's gotten better as it goes. Season two, we kind of like a little bit more. And I mean, you know, other than a few nitpicky things and a few things that feel a little lopsided, which we'll probably get answers to, I'm enjoying this season.
Yeah, most of the characters have gotten better. I mean, Grace, you know, is still the worst, but she's better. Ben's gotten a lot better. Michaela is still the worst cop ever, but she's a better character. Zeke is better. I think because I don't have to be all this like, Zeke might die. Now that Zeke's just not going to die. He's much more tolerable. Everyone's kind of better. Cal's better.
Yeah.
They're all better.
And Olive got to go to
Olive's
her prom.
Yeah, that's a little surprising to me that Olive would, like, I guess
you know
that she
funny?
Didn't want to go to the prom. Not that she couldn't get a date to the prom, but.
Well, you know what the thing is? I thought it kind of ended differently than I expected it to. I felt like the reason Olive decided to do it was because of the conversation with Angelina. And as soon as she brought Angelina with her, like, that whole thing made sense to me, you know? And then at the last minute, Angelina's like, no, it's your prom. Go ahead. Like, I didn't expect Angelina to not go in with her and go back to Pete.
So I didn't remember, and I agree with you up until the moment where I was like, oh, yeah, Angelina's like 30, like, right? She's like 28. She's pretty old,
well,
right? She's a grown woman, so it would be kind of weird for her to go to the prom.
Well, no.
So.
Well, it's a, it's a, She's 20. She should be 25. Because she makes a comment about that because she's been gone for 5 years. So
she was only 20 when she was on that plane.
I thought that's what she said. Maybe. Well, she's been gone for 5 years, so she's 5 years younger than she should be. Let's put it that way.
Okay. I thought she was kind of older that she had. I mean, I guess she never went to college because her parents wouldn't let her. I thought maybe she had. Anyway, I was like, oh, she's clearly not in high school. She's like a grown person. And I was like, okay, maybe this makes sense. She also wasn't dressed. Like, if you were really going to go to the prom with Olive, should have given you a better dress. Should have put a better dress on you.
There is that.
Because she was dressed like a chaperone, I guess. I don't know. I actually never went to a prom, and the chaperones at my high school prom were nuns, so they wore, like, clearly chaperone clothes. Which is why I never went to the prom. Because do you want to go to a prom with nuns?
No,
but,
I'm good.
Anyway, yeah, I agree with you. So. Like, I thought they were going in there together to have a good time up until the moment she was like, oh, yeah, she's kind of old. So I'd like to see a bigger role for her. I'd like to see Angelina's role become a little more expanded because I love Holly Taylor so much. And she's doing great, but I want to see her.
Yeah,
I'd love to see her be the star of the show because she's great.
Yeah, I'm sure it'll expand beyond this whole Pete thing.
I mean, I assume somehow Pete might get off. I don't see how he can get off because he's basically confessing, but they're going to have a relationship, those two. Like, he's going to survive his death date, I'm sure. And he's not going to just be in jail.
I don't know if they're going to have. I don't see them having a relationship. I mean, he could survive and still go to jail. Like, just because, you know, he's redeeming himself doesn't make it that he, you know, doesn't still have to pay for what he's done. You know what I mean?
So do you think his purpose is for Angelina? That's her name? Angelina?
Angelina.
The purpose is for Angelina's calling is just to help him and that'll be it? Like, or do you think there's, like, and then he can be gone because his purpose was her calling? Her calling was to help, like, she didn't really have a calling to save him. Like, he had a calling to get that coach put in jail, right? But her calling, and, like, to see, it's not clear to me what, the calling was for her to run into him, and then somehow he would, like, I don't know. I feel like she hasn't had her calling resolved yet. I don't really know what it is, other than them being together. But if it was just for him to
I don't see them being together. I don't see them being together like that.
So maybe he just survives his death date and he gets 5 years in jail and he's like, whatever. Because he didn't really do... I mean, he was an accomplice, but he didn't really do that much
right.
That was bad. And at this point, he'll clearly turn against Jace, right? He'll clearly be like, it was Jace's idea to try to kill Cal.
I mean, he could even end up getting some kind of immunity deal to capture Jace.
Yeah, he could. And that
who
would actually redeem him.
So.
And beat the death date, yeah. So, all right. We should move because we've got another big show to talk about. We're running out of time. I assume we've extended the show.
That's it.
No, Bone and Shadow. Shadow and Bone.
Oh, Jesus. I'm sorry. I completely forgot about that.
Well, we're only going to talk about the first episode real quick and not the whole show. So we're not going to be on forever.
It's just funny because I completely forgot about it. Like, I didn't even put it in our description tonight. Yes, I watched it. I just didn't put it in the description because I forgot about it.
Oh, okay. All right.
So initial thoughts, I like it. After the first episode, I said to Artie, I feel like it's kind of, I don't know if you've ever seen Avatar The Last Airbender, but it felt like a cross between that and his Dark Materials. That's kind of the vibe I got from it.
So I've never seen The Last Airbender, but his Dark Materials, it feels familiar in the sense that it's a typical YA story about a young girl who has no parents. It's always an orphan, right? Or their parents are absent or one is gone. And is different and excluded and then finds out she has secret powers and is the chosen one. Harry Potter, not really The Hunger Games, but to an extent The Hunger Games, like so many of the, you know, even like
yeah,
A Wrinkle in Time.
I know what you mean.
It's typical. But I liked it. I found this episode to be a little, I haven't read the books, and there's a lot of mythology to take in, and I rarely ask for more exposition, but I could have maybe used a couple of sentences of exposition here and there to help me put together the, I'm like, wait, what's this country called? What's the geography? Where do they live? Why is this, right? There's a lot of,
yeah.
And it's all sort of Russian feeling.
Yes.
But it's not, I'm like, wait, it's not like, don't overlay Russian history. That's not what it is. So I liked it. I felt a little bit of a need to know a little more. If I'd read the books, I'd know it all, right?
Yeah. I find myself liking those three thieves. I like them, and I'm pretty sure I'm not supposed to, but at the moment, I like them. I mean, I've only seen one episode.
Well, they're loaded with personality, right? Far more than the
yes.
main characters. I mean, they're very, like, that the woman in Nej, I want to know more about her immediately. She's like this incredible, like, stealthy thief who's indentured. And Kaz, walking with the cane, he's a little bit of a caricature. And Jesper, the cowboy sort of guy, is fantastic, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I like them also. Our main characters are likable, but a bit
one-dimensional in the first episode.
Yeah. Yeah, right? Orphans who are best friends. I mean, I got a real Katniss and Gale kind of vibe from them also, right? Like best friends from childhood, but there's definitely like latent romantic feelings there that are unexpressed.
Yeah, initially in the first episode, I definitely get it more from her than him. Like, I feel like when they're talking, she kind of felt, it looked like a lean in, and then he said something, whatever, and she kind of, like, backed up. So I feel like it's definitely, at least from the first episode, definitely more on her than him.
Yes, and he definitely seems to be a little more popular with both the guys and the ladies, and I mean just the guys in terms of his buds, and the ladies, right? Like, he,
In the Mal's not afraid of anything.
No. And in the flashbacks, she's a little bit more of the dominant personality. Not dominant, but he's a little more.
I know what you mean.
She's a little more hard, and then it seems to have switched as they get older because he's really tall and good looking. Although the idea that she's like mousy is a little. I mean, she's gorgeous also. I think they did a decent job with the racism thing, but not being too overdone or too. Now, I understand in the books that's not really a part of it. In the book, she's white. They cast a biracial actress and I think they did a pretty good job with that sort of casual racism that's a part of their daily life. But it's not just them, like people, the Grisha, who I guess are like witches, right? That's not really well explained yet, but they're like witches. There's also a lot of prejudice, a mixture of awe and prejudice of them also, right? Except they're sort of elite because of their powers. I don't know. There's all sorts of people discriminating against everyone. The thieves are poor and I don't know. There's all sorts of, but I thought it was pretty well done. Like it wasn't like an overtly, it was just a very casual sort of everyday sort of racism thing that they sort of deal with.
I was just gonna say, I got like an old timey British vibe, kind of like Sherlock Holmes type era.
Yeah, and it has a little. So I don't want to call it steampunk, and partly because I did watch that show, The Nevers, which maybe I'll mention a 1 minute thing about, really 1 minute when we're done with this. I would call it steampunk, and I think it is really inspired by, like, Imperial Russia, but it's not all Russian. A lot of it feels sort of like vaguely Turkish or Kosovo or Albania or with that whole, like, sphere of influence out there. But I did get that sort of, like, especially when they're in the town, which it's called, like, it's not called Ketterdam, it's called Ketterdam, right? Which immediately I think of Amsterdam.
Yes.
But it did feel more, like, British to me. I mean, I've only been to Amsterdam in the last 5 years, not in 18, whatever. I mean, the date is not clear on this show, but they are traveling by horse. So I was a little surprised. I was pleasantly surprised that the main character's awesome powers were revealed in the first episode. Like, I think a lot of these types of shows or stories or books hold that for a long time. Right? The character is working towards finding, whether it's, I don't know, I'm trying to think of all these YA stories like this, right? Like, I would think they might have held that for a couple episodes, but it was revealed really, I like that it was revealed right away. She's, what do they call it, a sun seeker? Sun summoner.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the whole basis, you know, the jumping off point, you know?
Right.
Because I heard that the story even starts to unfold.
And I think that's one season, right? It's three books, but I think they've put it into one season.
I have no idea. What I have heard is apparently they took the best parts of the book and the things that were a little weaker, they made them the parts stronger. So it's supposed to be the best of both worlds.
Yes.
From what I understand.
And it's actually, so I read that it's five books. It's three books that are about Alina and then two books that are about the thieves. And they've sort of mashed it up into a thing.
Mashed it up and everything, yeah.
Which I haven't read the books. It works for me. I thought
it
worked, this idea that these thieves are being enlisted to kidnap her.
That's kind of like, you know, The Expanse, where, you know, because you're watching it on TV, you can't have an entire season without, you know, like they gave Bobby a story and kind of made it up to make it lead into something that is actually in the books, you know?
Right.
You got to do what you got to do sometimes. Keep all your characters on the screen.
Yeah. So I think it was good looking. Like, I think it looks like a Netflix level, HBO level genre production, right? I mean, it's the
absolutely.
Great. It was filmed in Hungary. The costumes are fantastic. And yeah, I think it looks good. I mean, I'm gonna. Like, it's eight episodes, right? I'll watch it. I'll watch the rest of it. I think we're going to watch it and then just next week talk about the whole rest of it, right? Because it's all out.
Yeah, I'll have. Yep.
It all dropped.
I'll have it all done by next Tuesday.
Yeah. All right. I will, too. So I know we're going to wrap up in, like, 2 minutes. So I wish Jamie was here because I did. The Nevers is Jamie talked about. It's the Joss Whedon steampunk supernatural kind of show. It's set in Victorian England, and it's about people who, like, mostly women who have, like, powers that are sort of benign powers, but they have some level of supernatural powers, and one of them is, like, a crazy killer that the police are trying to catch. It has gotten pretty, like, C-plus reviews. I watched the first episode. And I thought the two main characters are great. I thought the two main characters are great and are really, like, good actresses with a lot of personality and chemistry. But in general, the mystery is very convoluted and kind of eh. And it didn't grab me as much as, say, Shadow and Bone did, right? I might watch another episode or two because it's on, but I don't know. It's getting a lot of criticism partly because it's sort of this, like, sort of feminist thing that was a Joss Whedon show who's really coming at a lot of criticism now for being sort of a feminist kind of a guy. But it was okay, but the story was, like, it was kind of convoluted and slow with, like, not good, again, with villains that are a little too over the top for my taste. So, I mean, it's okay. It's better than a lot of stuff. It's not really great. And I will just mention quickly what I mentioned to you when we texted, that I watched Cruel Summer on CW, which has zero genre content. It is a typical CW show about, you know, young women. And I thought it was really pretty good. And I mentioned to you that the conceit is that, so it's about teenage girls in the 90s, and it's about this girl, Jeanette, and what happens to her when another girl in the town goes missing. But the conceit is that it's the same date 3 years in a row. So the opening, you know, the premiere, the pilot is, it's June 21st, 1993, 1994, and 1995. And they show you Jeanette when that's her birthday. She turns 15, she turns 16, she turns 17. And she's like a nerdy, really cute girl at 15. And she's becoming more popular when she's 16. And then she's bitter when she's 17. And then you find out that a girl in the town went missing and, like, what happens to her. And I think this time traveling, it's not time traveling, but I think this time shifting thing is very well done in this show. It really, really works for me. And they've done a good job of using the character's hair and makeup, and the way they shoot it and the colors they use, like, triggers you right away to know what you're watching. I think it's really good. It's really shows a lot about how a teenager's life can really change in one or two or 3 years. Not just hers, but the parents really change a lot. I kind of like it. It gives me... So I don't want to say it's nothing like in the Wilds, but it's kind of like In the Wilds, but without any genre. I mean, I think actually, if you have nothing to do, you might watch the pilot and see if you like it. I don't know why it's set in the 90s, because it has nothing to do with the 90s, except that maybe they wanted a show with no cell phones, because it involves a girl disappearing. And it's easier to have a kid disappear when there's no cell phone to worry about, right? And it's easier to have, like, misunderstandings with no cell phone. So maybe they just wanted no social media and no cell phones. They actually, there's an element of it where they're showing archived news footage, which is very interesting and cooler than, like, archived social media comments. I think it's pretty good, and I'm not the target audience. So I think if you're hanging out, you might give it a shot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you and I tend to agree on what we're the target audience for, and if you like it, I'll definitely check it out.
Yeah, I think you might like it.
And speaking of the Wilds, I already told me tonight that they're filming season two as we speak.
New Zealand let them in. Yes, yes. I'm so excited.
So.
Of course, that makes it still like 8 or 9 months away, but there's hope for us. Hey, quickly, before we hang up, did you watch the Oscars?
No.
Oh,
watch that
so
popularity good. Contest.
Everything you've read about how bad it was pretty much correct. I can't believe that they chose to not show any clips of any of the nominated films. In a year where nobody went to the movies, they didn't show any clips of any movies.
Why would they do that? How are you supposed to know what you're voting on?
So when they introduced the movies, they were like, best director. So A.J. Grillo, when, you know, his first job was being a waiter. And during his downtime at Starbucks is when he started writing scripts. And then later he blah, blah, blah. And they all, like, everybody was introduced by some sort of personal thing of how they came into the movies. Or, like, something... Like, they tried to really personalize the nominees, but not really tell you about the movie. They showed zero clips. They did not play any of the songs that were nominated for Best Song. They didn't show any clips of anyone. It was really bad. And so I know some people criticize, oh, and also the speeches had no limit this year. You could talk as long as you wanted when you won an award. And actually, some of the speeches were actually pretty good and were way better than the introductions. And it let some people, in particular, some people who wouldn't normally get to speak, like your random, like, best sound director guy, got to really talk, and it was kind of cool. But it was a strange choice in a year when almost nobody saw any of the movies to not give us a teaser to make us see the movie, right? It was generally not a good show, yeah. All right. That's all I watched this week. Sorry, I'm done. I'm done ranting about my week of television.
All right. Well, this was a good show.
Yeah.
Excuse me. Hopefully Jamie feels better.
It was a good show. So, yeah.
Yeah, no. No. I was clearing my throat. Sorry.
I know. All right. So, back next week, next Tuesday.
Yep.
With our regular slate.
All the same shows.
Okay.
Minus Gary and Joyland.
Yep. All right. Good night, everybody.
All right. We'll do it again next week. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a good night.
Bye.
Bye.